I'm Floyd Hall, and this is a Wonder Root artist feature in conjunction with the Spelman College Museum of Fine Art. I have the pleasure today of speaking with artist Renee Stout. Renee, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Floyd. Hi, everybody.
Renee, first of all, I'm very happy to be speaking with you today. And I'd like to start off and get your perspective on alter ego, because you are currently working with or around or through your second alter ego. And I wanted to get some perspective of how are these alter egos separate from you, but also how are they close to you, and how do you interact with them?
Okay. Well, you know, I think the alter egos sort of came out of the fact that when I was growing up, I was a tiny little girl and I was very shy. And so I moved through life that way, especially since I also have a mother who's very, like, I don't want to say antisocial. It sounds extreme, but she's very shy and she doesn't like to go out or, you know, deal with people. And so I grew up, you know, being sort of like reticent to really, you know, put myself out there. And then once my work started getting out and I was invited to speak about the work, I was struck with such fear that I had to figure out a way to get out there and speak. So what started to happen was I created a projection that I could become when I went out to do this. So in a sense, I was basically acting, you know, I was being myself, but I created a character that I could psychologically hide behind. And so that's how the alter ego started. And then it was only later as I was like working, and sometimes when I'm in my studio and I'm thinking about why I make work or why I choose to do the things that I do, I started to realize, because I do a lot of I'm my own best therapist in the studio, okay? I started to realize that as a woman, especially a Black woman, from the time we're small, everybody projects onto you what they feel like you should be. You know, you're supposed to be the perfect child, the perfect daughter, you know, you be good. And you grow up being who everybody expects you to be. But then when you start to mature and you have this struggle because it's like, okay, you needed me to be that, but this is what I need to be for myself. I realized that the alter egos were actually the women that I wanted to be. And so I finally figured out that that's what it was. And when that had that breakthrough, suddenly they're not separate from me. They are me because it's the me that I've given myself permission to be.
So can you distinguish between Madam Ching and
Fatima
Mayfield? Yes.
I'll tell you what happened with that. Madam Ching was the first alter ego. And the reason why she's very different from Fatima is because I was younger when I created Madam Ching. And I was still in that, at that point where I was insecure and shy. And so I pictured the woman that I wanted to be as this mature woman in her 60s who had the power to say and do whatever she wanted. So I saw her as way older than I am. But what happened was, as I approached 40 and then 50, I started realizing, wait a minute. No, I'm the woman that I want to be right now, but I still got a ways to go, you know, to allow myself permission to do all I want to do. That's when Fatima Mayfield emerged, who is more close in age to me. That's actually the real me, basically. But I could still use her to blame all the stuff that I do on, you know. So so she's kind of the scapegoat for when I really want to act out, you know, and do what I do.
Well, let's talk about your art now, because a lot of your art is rooted in hoodoo and conjuring. When you first had an experience with conjuring or hoodoo, how old were you? Mm-hmm. What was that like? What did you think? What did you feel in that moment?
You know, it's kind of, my work is kind of like cyclical in that it goes back around, it goes out, it comes back to early experiences, it goes out further, it comes back. And I think that all this actually started when I was 10 years old. And because I was, you know, able to draw very well, and I was going to Pittsburgh Public Schools back then, my art teacher suggested me for these Saturday art classes. And so my father would take me to the Carnegie Museum of Art, where he would drop me off. And I was in this big lecture hall with a lot of other students from Pittsburgh Public Schools who were talented in drawing and things like that. And I was exposed to the museum. And I would go there every Saturday. And we would walk through the natural history part of the museum, where I encountered an African figure that they were calling a fetish back then. And I don't know if the viewers or, you know, yourself, or if you're familiar with these forms, but they're figures from the Congo that have nails driven in them. And I didn't know what that was back then, but I saw this thing in a case and I'm like, what is that? And I was just naturally drawn to it. And then I realized it was from Africa. But even back then, I knew that I was a black child, but we weren't using the term African-American. So I didn't fully understand why I was connecting to this. But I buried that image back in my mind. I end up going to Carnegie Mellon, majoring in painting. Eventually, I moved to Washington, D.C., where they have the wonderful National Museum of African Art. And when I started going there, when I moved to D.C., I would go to museums every Saturday. And I started to see more of these figures with more information behind them. And I started to make the connection that this is part of my heritage, and I want to look more into this. So from seeing that figure as a child, and then started to look more at African art, and then finding out about voodoo in Haiti, and then hoodoo in the southern United States, I started making all these connections. And so I was reading more and more and more, trying to find how these things related. And so eventually, because I'm an American woman, black American woman, I focused on hoodoo because I felt like that was what was ours. That's how we took the seeds of these African religions and used them to create a system that was a spiritual system. It wasn't necessarily a religion, but it was a spiritual system that put emphasis on nature and objects from nature to have the power to help us deal with that adversity and survive the things that we had to go through during slavery on up until, you know, the present. So hoodoo, to me, is so American, African-American, that I really finally settled on that's what I want to deal with, especially since in our culture, we want to bury it because we live in a Christian nation that doesn't want to have to deal with these things. And I don't want them to have to close the door on it. I'm going to put my foot in the door every time, especially African-Americans, trying to close the door on that.
So at least on the surface, it seems like there could be some conflict between the American Christian perspective and hoodoo. Are those things in opposition to each other, or are they complementary in a way?
You know what? It's both. Because you have the one school of thought that says, you know, like way, way, way back, like during slavery and shortly after slavery, where they took Christianity, you know, the slaves took Christianity and they melded it with their, you know, their beliefs that they retained from, you know, their heritage and, you know, African roots. And they used these things together. But then what started to happen, you know, there were cases where, you know, people fully embraced Christianity and felt that in order to fully embrace Christianity, you had to let go of those old beliefs. So you had two different things going on, which you still have going on today. You know, there's still you know, like some conjure people who believe you can use verses from the Bible to do conjure work and that kind of thing. So they're mixing these things. But then you have that other group that says, no, you can't mix these two things. So that's what I'm kind of dealing with in my work. And that Reverend Beach character that shows up in my work is sort of the metaphor for that sort of conflict and dealing with that.
Given the origins of hoodoo and its sort of amalgamation of ideas and beliefs and rituals, is there a certain established practicing sort of list of I would say rules or doctrines, or is it up to the individual?
That's the thing that I love about hoodoo. It's in a lot of ways up to the individual. You know, there are some basic things that reoccur, like, for example, High John the Conqueror root, you know, or love root, which is orris root, which is actually the bulb of an iris plant. But there are these general sets of things that are always used, but there's no hard, fast rules about how it has to be done, which is what I like. I like that idea that you have a certain set of things, but each person brings to it what they feel like they need to bring to it. You know, and I like that idea of that kind of flexibility, because I feel like that's the kind of spirituality that's able to survive, that can grow and morph and evolve, you know.
And with that being said, can you compare and or contrast hoodoo and voodoo, which I think a lot of people have some sort of some connection with or some awareness of within our popular culture?
Okay, you know, it's really a complex topic, but I'll just try to simplify it and say it. If you think in terms of, say, Haiti, where voodoo is, you know, prevalent. That's what, you know, it's Catholicism and voodoo. Voodoo is a religion with a certain set of deities, you know, who have personalities and attributes. And there is a kind of set of ideas or rules that do apply. Whereas in hoodoo, like I said, there's no set religion, but there is a belief that there is a higher power that you're drawing on, whether it's the spirits of the ancestors or your idea of who God is. So it's like one is more to me informal. The other one is like a religion with set ways of doing things, you know. So that's kind of the difference.
Well, let's shift now back to your work in the realm of the characters that you have created around your pieces. You mentioned Fatima earlier. You mentioned Reverend Beach as well. So talk about some of the characters that are reoccurring in your work and some of those themes around the characters.
Okay. Well, you know, the characters in my work actually started because, you know, I just enjoy being alive and living life. And I realized that in looking at my friends and myself and the way I interact with my friends or even strangers on the street, I created characters based on the people that I encounter in my everyday life. So I have a recurring character called Black Nine, who's a kind of composite of some dudes I know, right? Then I have a friend, Pretty Poison, who's Fatima's best friend, that is actually based on my real-life good friend, who is wild, whose birthday happens to be on my birthday. And even though we're very similar, we're like two sides of the same coin, because I need a sense of order, but I'm spontaneous, but I still believe that, you know, you have to have some order. You have to do things in a certain way. She wants to be completely wild. So in some ways, we look at each other, and I know I need to have a little bit more of what she has. She needs to have a little bit more of what I have. So in my stories, these two play off of each other. So Pretty Poison, who is depicted in one of my pieces in the show at the museum, that's a recurring character. Who else is there? Like I said, Reverend Beach. And then, you know, there's Hollywood, who's this strange dude that's actually in my neighborhood in D.C., who looks like George Clinton. Okay. So he's a recurring character, and he's actually depicted in one of the pieces as well. So, you know, and then I just create stories based on Fatima and her interactions with these characters.
With these characters and Fatima's role as a conjure woman, are there tales of, you know, love or revenge?
Oh.
And, you know, what?
Well, Fatima doesn't so much believe in revenge. And I think that the whole idea of conjuring, people sometimes, because of Hollywood movies and that, they go to the idea of casting spells and, you know, doing bad things to people. But, you know, I basically believe, you know, as a conjure woman, that you put the energy that you get is the energy you put out. So Fatima's always going to conjure for good or love or whatever. So, of course, the community would come to her and, you know, yeah, you know, I like this woman over here. What can you do for me? You know, so she's going to be doing that kind of stuff. And there's a lot of humor in that, you know, because people, love is just this subject that is just so absurd and funny to me. And so I deal with that a lot in the work.
Well, let's stay right there. And Fatima and her role in the community, because going back to Reverend Beach, mm-hmm. there was an image that I saw of a piece that's in the show. And it says, Reverend Beach says to not get any readings.
Right. It says Reverend Beach mm-hmm. said, stay away from Fatima and hoodoo. Don't get no readings.
And that struck me
uh-huh.
because I kept coming back to that.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me because I'm thinking about, is there some gender issue there? Is there a clash of culture as it relates to the monotheistic religious culture versus the hoodoo culture? And I wanted to get your perspective on that.
Mm-hmm.
Because in that one phrase, I feel like Fatima is somewhat of a spiritual leader
mm-hmm.
and the Reverend is one also.
Yes.
But they work in different ways.
Yes.
So I was wondering, is the Reverend feeling threatened in that moment where he's saying, do not go to her? But also, well, I guess from a culture perspective, but also from a gender perspective, is the fact that she's a woman also threatening to him?
You know, I'm really glad that you like that image, because to me, it's such a simple image, yet it really sums up, you know, that whole relationship between those two. And I would hope that the viewer would come to that just like you did. And all those questions arise, you know, based on looking at that image. And Reverend Beach is definitely threatened as a spiritual leader, you know, because, of course, a church is all about, you know, bringing in more and more people and having the big congregation. And he's threatened because he feels that if she is seeing people as well, would she help them more than he is? And would he, you know, lose parts of his congregation? Well, he's not losing any. They're just using both ways. You know, his congregation is actually going to both of them and getting what they need in different ways from each of them. But he doesn't see it that way. Fatima does. She realizes he's not a threat to her. You know, she's just extra added help in the community, but he doesn't see it that way. And so that's one level of it. And then, like you were saying, he comes from that traditional way of seeing a woman in a woman's role. He feels like she has some power. So he's threatened by her being a powerful woman. So there are some gender issues going on as well. And that's why, you know, that's the whole construct in the work. I'm dealing with the fact that Fatima is a powerful, you know, self-actualized, self-aware woman. And how does society deal with a woman like that? You know, even in today's society, that's a threat. You know, and those are some of the issues that I deal with in the work.
And for the viewers of that work, in particular, the women who view that work, or maybe even the entire story through all of these pieces, what do you want them to get out of that as they come to and experience all of these works?
What I would hope is that they would get out of it some of the things we just discussed today. You know, how does gender play out in society? How do we as women perceive ourselves even? You know, how does the community perceive us? How do we perceive ourselves? You know, how do you construct a person that you want to be? How do you allow yourself to be the person who you are and give yourself permission? And what I would hope the viewer comes and sees when they see my work is that I have allowed myself to play and lay myself bare and, you know, put the results of my asking myself all these questions and observing, you know, what I see in my life and how I'm dealt with as a person and a woman. And that's what the show's all about. I'm laying myself bare. I mean, you know, there are pieces in there like Armored Heart, Caged Heart, where I deal with the idea of being vulnerable in love as opposed to trying to protect yourself. And then when you overprotect yourself because you have a fear of being vulnerable, then you shut yourself off from actually being able to love fully. So there are personal things going on. There are things that are not so immediately personal, but still based on, you know, personal things that I've dealt with. But then I've embellished them by creating a story. So I don't know if the viewer is going to notice, but there are a couple of things that make reference to Sterling Rochambeau, who is Fatima's love interest. So you never see him, but you see the evidence of her pondering her relationship with him or how she's going to seduce him. So there's some of that going on, you know. So I just want the viewer to come and play and open up their minds and their imaginations to, you know, I'm not going to tell you the whole story, but I'm going to lay some things out there and let you complete the story for yourself. You know, it's always open-ended.
Well, you mentioned that last part about Fatima and Sterling, and I was going to ask you about sort of the solitary, it seems, nature of a conjure woman, because it always seems that there's a large amount of time spent in solitude for her or for you. So could you speak to that?
You are asking all the right questions, because one of the things that I realize Fatima's about is the solitary nature of being an artist, a visual artist. I spend a lot of time in my studio by myself, and I work because I have shows I have to do. And Fatima's the root worker, and the community comes to her, and they need certain things. And so when she's by herself, you know, she's looking at her notes and she's constructing these charms they may need or these remedies they may need. She never has any time for herself. And so one of the layers of the work is dealing with the fact that she can't just be sometimes and go out and play and be a woman and have fun. And Pretty Poison, her friend, is that voice that says, you need to go out, you need to be wild, you need to do this, you need to do that. And it deals a lot with being by yourself and feeling the responsibility of having a duty and performing, you know, that duty. And I know you mentioned before we were having like a conversation just before we, you know, went on air. And you were asking about the idea that, you know, people sometimes when they see, you know, they think root worker. They think of this like older woman, you know, or and, you know, there's a 6-minute film that goes along with the exhibition. And it shows the Conjure Woman walking around in her environment. And one of the things that I discussed with the filmmakers when they were doing it, because they had their idea of what a root worker was. They were thinking rural. They were thinking older woman. And I'm like, you know what? Fatima is very urban. That's where she does her thing. But she loves going into rural areas. So we can depict sort of rural areas. And we do in the film. But she's also walking down Florida Avenue, you know, which is a main drag in Washington, D.C., okay? And I said, and I want her to be sexy. I said, you know, people picture the root woman as being this sexless, you know, spooky person that's all she's doing is dealing with roots, you know. But there's that sensual, sexual woman as well. So that comes across in the show.
I would like to take that a step further and ask about going from the rural setting to the urban setting, but even going from the urban setting into this digital space that we're in right now. How does that work? Or how would you imagine the role of a Conjure Woman 50 years from now when our society may be so virtual that the virtual side and the real side may be equal parts?
Okay. You know what? How am I going to answer that? This is funny because back in the 90s, I did a piece before I even had a computer. I didn't have a computer in the 90s, right? I didn't need one. You know, now I do. Everybody communicates by a computer. But even before I had a computer, I conceived of a piece called The Traveling Root Store. And I took this black suitcase that looked in a way like a big doctor's bag. And in my imagination, the root worker did house calls. So she carried this bag. You opened this suitcase up. There were roots and all kinds of vials of, you know, things that people would need. But in the center was a computer screen and a keyboard. And I had removed all of the symbols off the keyboard and put special secret symbols where she could access the spirits through the computer. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, she came up to the 21st century before I did. So so that's the way I imagine it. And even now in my studio, some of the work that I'm working on right now, I have these old radio tubes and all kinds of parts from technology, things that I've pulled apart, you know, computers using, you know, the chipboards and the circuit boards. And I'm creating these devices where Fatima is tuning into spirits on a radio. There are no numbers, but when she turns it, she's turning to Elegba or Ogun, you know. So that's how I sort of deal with, you know, the futuristic root woman.
Okay. All right. Well, looking at the contemporary art world, because I feel like your art may not fit as nicely and neatly inside of what the contemporary art world is maybe used to. So how do you live in that space?
That's a hard place to live in because as a self-employed artist, you know, this is my profession. I don't have like a teaching job to fall back on. And so I make my money off of my art. And because I do the kind of work that I do, like you're saying, that's not fitting in neatly the way they need things to fit in this art world, this contemporary art world, I don't make the sales that I probably could make if I would just craft my way of thinking to the art world, which I would do. I could do it. I know how to do it, but I'm not going to do it because I have this vision that I have to be faithful to. And I have this story that I have to tell. And I have to stay with that and make the art that I feel like I need to make. So as a result, you know, I'm not a an artist who, you know, has a lot of money or resources to create the work that I really want to make, but at the same time, I have made the work that I can make with what I have that's true to my vision. So it's a hard place to be in right now.
As we wrap up, I wanted to go back to the notion of fear, maybe, that your work could invoke to some people, or maybe discomfort. Maybe that's a better word for it. There's some discomfort there with people who believe or subscribe to maybe traditional Western religion, and the work or the emotions that your work brings forth. Talk more about that fear, or maybe that discomfort between other African Americans and your work, or what they've been taught to believe, mm-hmm. or just how to reconcile that in terms of what you're creating and how you fit within your community.
Okay. Well, you know, it's interesting because when I first started doing the work that I was doing, I was thinking that, okay, I'm going to take these ideas that are based in African belief systems, and I'm going to deal with this in my work, and I'm going to be putting a part of our heritage out there, and people are going to connect to it. And then I was wrong because, you know, in a lot of instances, I would see that people were afraid of the work. And it's like, well, why are you dealing with that in the work? And I realized that it stems from slavery when, you know, the slaves were forced to basically, you know, subvert their own religion and deal with Christianity on the surface, you know. And these African religions sort of went underground and they were hidden. And, you know, as people felt like they were assimilating fully, that meant embracing Christianity fully and letting go of those beliefs. And in people were taught that that was devil's work. If you believed in anything that was based in African, oh, that's demon work, devil's work. Don't deal with that. And so that's what I think the fear is. You know, it's like when the civil rights movement came, basically people started really embracing their hair texture. You know, they were in afros. You know, you had dreadlocks. Oh, I can wear a dashiki. I can wear African dress. But nobody was going to deal with African religion. That was the one taboo. We're not going there, you know. And so I thought that was very interesting. We're going to embrace everything but that, you know. So it's even today, even though you have like Santeria, you have like Yoruba religions, you know, there are communities that are dealing with this openly in some ways, it's still in some ways kind of a taboo, and people still have a fear of that. So that's what I'm dealing with. And, you know, the question of what this fear is about is the question I'm always asking. We are in fear of ourselves, ultimately.
Renee Stout, Tales of the Conjure Woman, on display at the Spelman College Museum of Fine Art. Renee, let everyone know how they can find out more about your work outside of that exhibit and what else you may have going on.
Okay. If you punch my name into Google, stuff comes up. And so there's all this stuff. So, and then also right now I'm working on a collaborative show with a self-taught artist from Durham, North Carolina named Odinga Tahimba. And we are just playing in the studio, making up stuff like we're kids making mud pies. And the exhibition's called Incubator. And we're just going to see where it goes. That's what I'm doing right now.
Renee, thank you for your time. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me, Floyd.